Inside 20 for those with the desire to hunt close. Brought to you by Big Jim's Bow Company, Traditional Bow Hunters of Georgia, Gunshy Archery, Vantage Point Archery, Pack Rat Outdoor Center, and Lancaster Archery Supply. The information shared from each episode are the beliefs of the Inside 20 associates and the guests participating.
By the time you're listening to this podcast, turkey season has officially begun for 2024. When we thought about who could we bring on as a guest this year to talk turkeys, we knew it needed to be somebody that was unmatched with their passion for the pursuit. Not only is Shane Simpson passionate about turkeys, but he's a master of his craft. How you doing tonight, Shane?
Doing pretty good. I'm excited to get out there.
It's here. It's right here, right over the hill. We've been waiting all year for it.
A couple more days or a few more days and then I'll be out there. So I'm itching to get out there, that's for sure.
And this is the biggest passion for you, right, as far as hunting, is turkeys.
Yeah, and deer's a close second. It used to be a far second, but I'm getting more passionate about deer. But turkey, I don't think it'll ever surpass turkey. Turkey's just something I've loved to do all my life. And I think the passion for it just gets stronger and stronger each year.
When did you start turkey hunting? Or when was your first turkey you killed? How old were you?
I started when I was like 13 or 14, and I had no clue what I was doing. We had 50 acres of a family land, and then it butted up to some public, and my dad didn't hunt and basically just gave me a shotgun. I went wandering out there. I don't even know if I had a license or if I was allowed to hunt by myself at the time, but we grew up in rural South Carolina, and we didn't always follow the rules or look at the rules. I was a kid. I didn't know any better, but I ran into this fella, and he gave me some tips about turkey hunting. And gave me a brand new mouth call he had in his pack. And I went home and started practicing with it, started reading up on it. And I think it was the following spring that I killed my first turkey. And then 2 days later, I called in a big old long beard and killed him. And I was on a roll there from the get-go, it seemed. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I went a single season without killing a gobbler from that day. So I've been very fortunate. And I think what really helped me is that guy giving me that mouth call was the first call I had. And so I started working on the mouth call from the get-go. And I think that helped, especially when turkey comes in and gets close and you can make those little sounds without movement.
Yeah, it's something hard for a lot of people to master is that mouth call. And you starting out early and being forced, that was the only call you had, right? That's what you're saying. You had to get good at that. That was a perfect call to master if you're going to get good at one for that sense.
Exactly. And I don't think I ever had a pot call or a box call until a couple of years later. We weren't well off when I was growing up, still not well off, but I guess we were what's the opposite of well, not so well off. We didn't have a lot of money. We lived week to week. My family did. And I wouldn't be able to ask my dad to go spend 30 or 40 bucks or whatever it was for turkey calls. I basically bought a lot of my calls myself. If I had some extra money from chores or doing whatever, to buy mouth calls. Eventually, as I got older and started working, I did some work for my cousin, his ice company, when I was 15, 16 years old, something like that. I got some extra money. I bought my first turkey vest. So my family, my mom and dad bought me stuff. Obviously, we weren't flat broke. It wasn't like I could go get turkey calls left and right. I had to choose wisely. And most of the time, it was just getting mouth calls because they were pretty cheap.
Makes sense. And you can have multiple of those too. Easy to pack, easy to walk around with, lightweight, right? All the positive things when it comes to taking stuff with you in the woods.
Yeah, exactly. But I was one of those guys early on. I had a vest. I wanted to put something in every pocket.
And you're going to fill it up.
And nowadays I'm totally opposite. I want to carry as few calls as possible. I have a little call pouch or call case in my pocket that has about four mouth calls in it, an owl hooter, and then one pot call I carry. And that's it for turkey calls. I try to keep it to a minimum. I just want to be more mobile and less stuff to worry about.
Seems like a narrative for a lot of people that have more season in a type of hunting. They get to the point to where it just becomes a pain to take a bunch of stuff. Plus, you film a lot of your hunts too, right? So you have to take all that extra gear on top of that with you, which kind of weighs you down.
Oh yeah, if I had a vest full of turkey calls and all my camera stuff, I'd have 50 pounds of stuff right now. I'm even trying to narrow down my camera gear to minimal stuff. I got my main camcorder and 360 camera and maybe one or two action cameras. And sometimes I'll carry the tripod with me. If I'm filming somebody else, I'll just hand carry my camcorder. But a lot of it, I don't know if it's really, you know, part of it is I want to carry less. I think most people do. But also, as I've gotten older, I've learned that all the extra stuff is not necessarily necessary. You read in the books, magazine stuff growing up, I think a lot of that was bad instructions or bad tips. They tell you to call, carry a couple calls, sound like multiple hens or different hens. I get it. It definitely can help sometimes. But I just get to the point now, I think I can sound like two different hens on the same mouth call. I can do the same thing on a pot call. The sound, if a gobbler's not interested in one hen, usually they're not interested in the other hen that you're trying to sound like. And most people sound like the same hen no matter what call they're running. It's just I don't know. I think a lot of it is I just feel it's unnecessary and not necessarily that I'm trying to save weight, but at the same time, it is a bonus to carry less.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you do hear that a lot. A lot of people do talk about it. And I think I've read it in articles before about trying that tactic. And I haven't heard somebody put it that way, but it does make sense. I've been in situations before where birds hang up and you try everything what you think sounds different and it doesn't do any good. So there's got to be something said for somebody like you also saying that makes sense. All right, I got a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So what are you looking for when you're scouting maps ahead of time before you go to a new state specifically, before you put boots on the ground to try to make you a little bit more efficient time-wise once you get to that new state?
Oh, gosh, I get that question often. And it's so hard to answer because without looking at a certain piece and you asking me on this little picture or this map, what am I looking for? It varies so much from state to state. If I'm in flat terrain, then a lot of times I'm looking for transition lines. That's a big thing. So I'll give you an example. Northern Minnesota, northern Wisconsin, northern Michigan, a lot of those areas are just a monotony of trees and it's flat terrain. And where do you even start? And I'll try to look at the map and try to decide what is bigger mature trees. And then are there transition lines where they maybe cut the timber or they're cut it in the past? There's just some smaller growth or a creek where it transitions from pines to like hardwoods. Those are areas I'm going to concentrate on. And the creeks themselves, whenever there's water, that will a lot of times attract turkeys. Transition lines and creeks that flow year round, not just seasonal drainage creeks or whatever. And then I'm looking at access roads. If there's roads that I can, paths or whatever, I can walk quickly to cover a lot of ground. It's a lot easier to cover ground quietly if you have these long couple mile access trails, and especially if vehicles aren't allowed on them. That's a nice benefit because you can walk and you can look for gobbler tracks where they cross the road sometimes. That's what I'm focusing on, those terrains. But then a lot of areas I like hill country. That's some of my favorite stuff to hunt, hilly terrain. And on those, it gets a little tricky. If there's ag around, it's a little easier, especially if there's ag fields on top. I'm looking for those nice wooded points that come off the field. A lot of times I'll find that gobblers are roosted out on those points. And the main thing is I'm looking for an area to, if I get there on day one, you know, I've been riding around getting a feel for the area. I'm looking for areas where I can call from the road, owl hoot from the road, and reach as many points and ridges or reach as far of an area as possible, as many areas I think may hold roosting turkeys or areas they may roost in. And if there's a grid of roads, the better, because then I can drop a bunch of pins during the day and say, okay, I want to cover this area, and I'll start at one spot and I'll boogie to the next and I'll owl hoot it right in the last 30 minutes of light trying to pinpoint. That's where I've found a lot of success, just trying to pinpoint gobblers on the roost in the evening, and then I can go be in there real close to them the next morning.
And it varies too by region. In the evening too, getting birds to gobble. Have you seen in the southeast specifically, you're not hearing them in the evening on the roost? Has that been an experience?
Yeah, it's hard to get them to gobble down south and southeast in the evening. I do get it to happen occasionally, but it's not as often as you do like up in the West and Midwest and in the Northeast and that sort of thing. I think a lot of that has to do with hunting pressure. So many years of diehard turkey hunters down there, and turkey hunting is relatively new up here. It's probably been going on half as long as it has been down there. And the number of diehard turkey hunters, the ones that look forward to it and hunt, even though there's a one bird state here, those guys fill their tag, or they go out and attempt to fill their tag a few times and then they're done. There's not many diehard hunters that they fill their tag and then they go out and take other hunters and they try to spend as much time out in the woods as possible, even if they don't have a tag to fill. And so I think that combination has the birds where they're still willing to gobble on the roost in the evening compared to down south.
Makes sense. So unique. It's interesting how unique it varies like that.
What's that?
It's really interesting how unique and how it varies just from the bird species and the region, the area. It's interesting.
And the other thing is, I had a buddy that came up here and hunted from Mississippi. I wasn't hunting with him, but I was, you know, talking to him on the phone and stuff while he was up here and after he left. And he's like, man, I couldn't believe it. The birds up here, they gobble well. And he said that there was one that was roosted near the road. I had one where I was staying come across the driveway. And I said, you know why that is, right? He's no. I said, because the people up here, they see a turkey on the side of the road roosted or across the road. They just ride by and look at it, maybe take a picture. I said, Mississippi, that turkey's getting shot from the road. That's the difference.
The South, that makes sense.
Those birds, they know better than the roost beside the road down there, and they don't gobble me because they'll get their butt shot out of the roost. I hate to say it, but that is more, it's going to happen more often down there than up here for sure.
It is. Deer, too. People ask, why'd that deer just run off and slow down? There's a reason behind that.
Yep.
So what do you think is more important to be successful on public land? Is that the woodsmanship aspect, like the points you've been making, or learning how to get good with a call and understand when to call where and what calls to do when?
So a lot of people try to separate the two, and I used to be in that party also. I think good calling is part of woodsmanship. If you can sound, the closer you can sound, more realistic you can sound like a turkey and know when calls to use and when to use it, or somewhat know when to use it. No, I don't think anybody's ever going to figure it out perfectly. That's woodsmanship. If you've studied turkeys long enough and listened to them long enough, you've learned that stuff. You've learned some woodsmanship. And then moving through the woods, knowing when to move, how to move, how to use a train, that's all. There's a lot of aspects to woodsmanship, and I think it all should be combined in together. But if you separated, say, most people think of woodsmanship as knowing how to move through the woods, and then they classify calling as separate. Obviously, someone who can't call well but is great in the woods, as a woodsman, be able to move around and read sign and stuff, I think they're going to have an advantage over someone that lacks woodsmanship but can call great. I see it, man. I see these competition callers, the top-notch callers, and I've seen them in the woods, and they don't have the woodsmanship, and sometimes they struggle. They don't know the right moves to make. But someone that possesses both skills, that's a deadly combination. You look at Dave Owens, for instance. He's a great woodsman from what I can tell. I've hunted with him a couple times years ago. He knows how to move through the woods. He knows when to move, all that good stuff. And he's a great caller. I think that's why he's very successful in the woods. But I'd have to give the edge to straight woodsmanship if you had to pick one as being something better to have over calling ability. But do not for one second discount being able to call, being able to JK. A lot of people think when you say calling abilities, oh, I can yelp. I can yelp on a box call. There's so much more to calling than that. Jake yelping, being able to change the type of yelps, transition from a soft to a loud yelp, tree yelps, kikis, everything, gobbling on a mouth call or on a call, period. Doesn't have to be a mouth call. Be able to mimic a hen that's calling to you and cutting and stuff. There's so much to it than just yelping. That's a big task trying to answer that question. But in a nutshell, I think the woodsmanship is going to have the edge. But to summarize, calling is important too.
Yeah, just being able to tie it all in together and know when to, it's like a quarterback, knowing when to apply the play you learned in practice and run it with your team. Mm-hmm. That's good. It's a good way to put it. I like that. When you're hunting on public land specifically, have you had any type of negative encounters with just random hunters you run into? Does that happen? And if it has, is it something you see often or is it pretty rare?
It's pretty rare for me. I'll give you two examples, and they're pretty low-key. The one example that was in Mississippi, I was getting ready to put my kayak in at the on the river, and another fella pulls up, and I was just going to make friendly chit-chat with him, try to find out, you know, where he was going so I wouldn't run into him. And he was very short of me. He said, "I'm going up river," and he just turned around and left me. Yeah, that wasn't bad. He just, he had no desire to communicate with me. And which that was about the worst of it up until, I just thought of one other out in Kansas one time. I pulled up at the spot and I started walking in, and I seen headlights coming. The car stopped behind me and I started to turn around to go chat with them. But the guy I was with, he said, "Oh, don't worry about it. They'll see our tracks in the mud and know which way we went." When we got done hunting, they left a nasty note on my truck and taking a big old dump right between the vehicles. And
oh,
my buddy my buddy stepped in it.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, he was cussing up a storm. But I'd say recently, so that was probably the worst of it. Recently was here in Minnesota 2 years ago, I think it was, two springs ago maybe. I pulled into a spot. I had these birds roosted. I got in there real early. And there's access points all over. You can park at any spot. And this knucklehead came in there and parked right next to my truck and walked right on the other side of the turkeys. And I know he could hear me calling. He knew I was there. He saw my vehicle. And he was on the other side. I could hear him calling, getting closer to him. And he ended up bumping the birds. And I'm like, oh, God almighty. It pissed me off. All those spots. And I went ahead and just left. And every spot down the road was empty. He wanted to go to the one that I was at. Maybe he had some experience at that spot and knew there was some birds in there. I don't know, but it still doesn't. You know, some people just don't know respect. And I think up here, back up a little bit, up here when you're deer hunting, it's not uncommon. It's probably down south too. It's not uncommon for there to be multiple vehicles in a parking spot to go hunt a big chunk of public or an area, even if there's access down the road. Because most deer hunters get in a tree and they sit quietly until dark. People get there in the early afternoon. Up here, I don't think they've figured or learned it that turkey hunting is a different thing, a different animal. And you're going to be running and gunning and stuff. And up here, the mentality for turkey, a lot of guys up here, they go plop down in one spot and they deer hunt turkeys. They sit one spot and they call and they sit there for hours. And so they still have that mentality. If there's a vehicle parked there, oh, it doesn't matter. I'll just go and I'll sit in the woods and one of us to get it, you know what I'm saying? And I see it in the comment sections on these Facebook groups here in Minnesota where they're like, there's plenty of land there for us to share. I'm like, dude, there's like 500 acres. I may be all over that 500 acres. Go to the other 500 acres a mile down the road.
Yeah,
but that makes anyway, sense. I think they just haven't learned that because of the lack of years of turkey. It happens down south too. People will come in on top of each other. So let me say it's not going to happen down there either.
And sometimes it happens on accident too. It's not always intentional. Yeah. People are, like you said, just not knowledgeable, not understanding.
Yeah. And I can understand if there's one access point and it's the only, like I can think of a piece of public up here in Minnesota where there's only one access point to the entire public and there's a trail that goes right down the middle. Something like that, I would expect to be, you know, two or three vehicles parked there and they go down in there and all go to different spots. But when you have a 500-acre piece and there's four access points, the other three are empty, and I'm sitting at one, and you come parking the same one I'm in, then there's an issue there. There's, you know, a lack of respect.
Yeah, and then that's just mentality sometimes, unfortunately, with certain people. And you just got to, like you said, you got to look past that. There's a few examples.
Yeah, I get a little upset about it sometimes. That's only happened really that once, maybe one other time, I can't recall. I'm a pretty low-key guy. I know there's other turkeys out there. I don't let it get to me. Somebody comes in on top of me. In the instance of that guy, I was pissed, but I left and I went to another spot and I got on bird somewhere else. And I think I either killed one that day or the next morning. I can't remember, but that's the way I look at it. There's other opportunities out there. I'm not going to dwell over one instance.
That's exactly right. What is it that intrigues you so much about hunting public land? Is it just the unknown, the fact of it, the challenge where you got other people? Is it just going to new places? What is it that drives you?
Several of those things apply to me. New places, that's a big one for me. There's public places I hunt, and I get tired of them seeing the same spot over and over. I could go in there and kill a gobbler, but I get bored with it. I've seen the same thing over and over, and I just want a new experience, new terrain to try and figure. It's like a puzzle. And then if I get on bird, then I'm trying to strategize what to do without really knowing what's up ahead. So that intrigues me, the new places. The other thing is the public usually ends up being a bigger chunk of land to give me more room to roam, to maneuver on birds, to circle around on birds, or to just spend the day walking and scouting, looking for sign and trying to strike birds or locate birds. I've had experiences hunting private, and what always ends up happening is a smaller piece of land, or I've got to deal with, hey, just check with me when you can go whenever you want. Just check with me before you go back in there in case I'm going to be back there or something. You got all these stipulations is what I've dealt with in the past. And then if I've hunted with someone on private, they know all it. And so I feel like I'm not part of the strategy. I'm just following them. So a lot of that plays into it. And then part of it is I want to be able to challenge myself. I want to find a bird that's not going to come running to the call and be an easy kill. Like I went and hunted some private I have access to here in Minnesota, and I took my daughter there, and those birds were, I wouldn't say they were tame, but they weren't 100% wild. You know what I'm saying? I went in there deer hunting one time, and I come across a flock of about 20 of them, and they were like 30 yards out in front of me, and they just walked away from me at the pace I was walking towards them, trying to get to where I wanted to deer hunt. And I'm like, if that had been a public land gobbler, had been seeing hunting pressure, it would have been flying away. Nothing against people who hunt private, but I don't want to encounter those types of birds. It may be a wary bird I may encounter, but I want to try to ensure that I get a chess match out of it, if you will.
Yeah, that the challenging part is often what you hear people say that intrigues them when it comes to hunting public land. And then two, you choose to hunt without a blind and without decoys, and you talk about minimalist and what you take in the woods with you. You're not having all this fancy gear that you often see advertised. And so that mentality of let's make it as challenging as possible. So then that reward that I might see at some point is even sweeter at the end of the day, right?
Yeah. And I wouldn't say it's make it as challenging as possible. Hunting out of a blind, a lot of people look at that as making it easier. I don't. I think hunting out of blind just made it for me a pain in the butt, something to carry, and less vision around you, less hearing ability. You'd hear a gobble, and you wouldn't know which way it came from, or if it was far enough away, you wouldn't even hear it at all in the blind. And then it would affect my decision-making on whether to move or not. A lot of times I was like, do I really want to break this blind down? So I look at using a blind as more of a handicap than helping me. People associate on people hunting the blind. I just think, to me, it hurts me more than anything. And that was the reason. It wasn't that it's more challenging. I just, now, if you're looking at hunting with a bow or something like that, and a blind is beneficial to hide your draw movement. But when you're sitting there with a shotgun and a turkey comes in, doesn't matter if you're in a blind or not, you're not going to be moving. So I look at it as more of a hindrance than anything, hanging out blind.
Yeah, trying to tote one around with you, especially walking around for miles on public land.
Giving me flashbacks. I hate it. I was glad when I used to take my daughter hunting when she was younger, and we hunted out of a blind just because she moves a lot. And then one day she's, can I hunt like you, Daddy? I was like, what do you mean? Without the blind, we sit against a tree or something. I was like, heck yeah, let's do it.
She couldn't ask fast enough, right? That's awesome.
She slept just as much outside the blind. Early on, she'd sit between my legs, and that way I could help her with the gun and stuff. And I guess my warm belly, you know how it is. You get tired out there turkey hunting, the kid especially. And she'd there, make my body was warm, and she'd be out like a light.
She'd be asleep. As long as you didn't fall asleep, you were good. So I got to ask this. How old was she when she first went with you? Because I got a little girl.
I took her actually when she started going out in the woods with me a couple times when she was like three. We would walk and listen to gobbles when she was like 2 and 3 years old. And she sat with me once when she was three, at least once. But then when she was 4 years old, I actually took her turkey hunting, and she missed a hen. Took her fall turkey hunting up here in Minnesota, and she missed a hen. And she was confident she shot that hen. She said, can we go look for it? I said, we can go look for it, but I saw it run away. And we got out of the blind and we was walking around just looking. And thankfully, another hen was in the cover just around the curve and it took off running. She saw it run away. She said, oh, there it goes. It's fine. And I said, yep, that's the one. Yeah, it was a totally different hen. But she didn't get her first turkey until she was six. And
that's still young. And then, that's great.
Yeah, yeah. I'm surprised she handled that gun great. Had a little shooting stick thing where the gun propped on it. And so all she had to do was put her shoulder up to it and look at, and I had a red dot on it. I think that's a lot what a lot of people should do if they're getting a youth out there with red dot availability these days. Yeah. It makes it so easy for them to aim. If you're trying to teach a kid how to look down the barrel at a bead and get down on the gun, you don't know what they're looking at, and you can just talk to it with a red dot. You just tell them, put that red dot on the neck, and she shot it in target, and she would nail it. Throw a Mountain Dew can out there, and she'd nail it. I'm like, yeah, you're good to go. The problem with that hen she missed was it started walking, and when she decided to shoot, she stopped following it, and she shot behind it, and the hen was still moving.
Yeah, it's still going.
Yeah.
What gauge shotgun was she shooting when she was four when she missed that bird?
Inside 20 is brought to you by Gunshy Archery, the perfect custom-made bow-mounted quivers for both 2 and 3-blade broadheads. Head over to gunshyarchery.com, Big Jim's Bow Company, the place for handmade leather goods, custom bows, and more. You can find them at bigjimsbowcompany.com. Also by Traditional Bow Hunters of Georgia. Become a member today at tradbowga.com. Use Inside 20 in the reference field so they know who sent you. Lancaster Archery Supply, leading the world in 3D and target archery. Check them out at lancasterarchery.com. VPA Broadheads, precision-made one-piece broadheads in 2 and 3-blade models. Use code INSIDE20, spelled out in one word at checkout for 10% off your entire order. And Pack Rat Outdoor Center, best selection, most experience. Head on over to packratoc.com to pick up gear for your next adventure.
It was actually a 20 gauge.
What was it?
The one I'm actually hunting with this spring is a Mossberg 510 mini Bantam. It's like, okay, got an 18 inch barrel. It's a teeny gun. I put an adult stock on it, put my red dot on it. I moved it down the barrel a little bit, the red dot. But I was just patterning it today. It shoots great out to 40 yards. And I had low recoil shells in it at the time when she was four. And she had no problem shooting. I thought she would not like it because I first shot it she had some bird shot in there and nothing at all. And then when she shot at the turkey, it was turkey shells, but it was a low recoil, I think, from Federal that they gave me. And she didn't complain about that at all. But then when she got older, we're talking about, I forget how old she was. We're talking about 9 or 10 years old. She didn't like it anymore. She wanted to shoot something with less recoil. And I got a 410 for her. And she loves that. Even now, when she's 14 years old, she won't shoot that 20 gauge again. I'm like, you shot it when you were 4 years old and didn't complain one bit. You were excited to go hunting again. And now,
that's right.
I don't know. I guess I get it. I don't like the recoil either. I went out there and I bet I shot 10 rounds today patterning my gun. Or just I was trying different chokes and things, just different combinations. Even with a 20 gauge, a much lower recoil than the 12 gauge I've been shooting for the past 10 years, it's still not fun to sit there and shoot at turkey loads at a target.
Yeah. It's probably because she was thinking about it too. Like you said, you start out bird shot and they don't even know because adrenaline's rushing. And turkey shot in there. It's a good tactic. So I got to ask this. We have seen multiple videos of you taking a traditional bow in the woods when you're turkey hunting. And that's what sprung us. Not only your woodsmanship skills and your ability to pull birds in and successfully kill birds with a shotgun, but the aspect around you hunting with a traditional bow for turkeys without a blind, without a decoy. And frankly, I think one of the clips I saw, you didn't even have a kill suit or a ghillie suit on. So tell us, what is something, or if there's multiple things that you feel like you've learned in some of those hunts the hard way that you didn't know or you didn't think about going into it, that now you plan to apply going into these future hunts with a stick bow?
I've learned that setup, and I figured that out really quick. Setup is the most important thing, position and everything, because you've got to not only get the birds close, but you've got to set up in a location where they're going to want to come close, you know, within 15 yards. And the other thing is you've got to be able to draw and release without them spooking or without them running away before you can go through that whole movement. And that's the biggest challenge. Like the one I killed, that Miriam's I killed, my recurve, I found a little logging road, the access road or something that came up through the woods. It was overgrown war. It hadn't been used in a while, but I was like, turkeys will naturally take that. And I was like up on a little slightly higher ground, about 8 to 10 feet more in elevation. And I'm like, he's going to want to come up here where he heard this hen, and he's going to probably take that little access road. And I was on one side of it, but because I'm a right-handed shooter, I didn't want to be, I was sitting on my knees on the ground. I didn't want my butt facing down the hill where he's coming from and trying to shoot right-handed across, if you can picture that. So I decided to crawl across to the other side so that I'm on my knees and facing where he's coming from. And then I'm drawing right-handed shooting to my left towards the access road. And also, I could see there were some small cedars on that side, so I knew it would give me an opportunity. He passed right behind a cedar, a small cedar, and it gave me an opportunity because I'm a snap shooter. I wanted it to be one smooth movement, so he passed behind that little tree. I tried to time it, so as I'm drawing, he would pop out, and I'd be ready to finish in my draw cycle and release. So that's the biggest thing, and I've been struggling with that because this year I plan to try to get an eastern wild turkey here in Minnesota with my recurve. And it's going to be a lot bigger challenge. Those birds are naturally wary because they get a lot of hunting pressure from the gun hunters, myself included. But I got to figure out a way that I can't think of any of the spots I hunt where there's going to be a little access trail or same situation. And the woods don't necessarily have little cedars growing in them. They're more open. And I'm sitting here scratching my head. I said, okay, I know there's plenty of fallen trees in these woods. I practice laying on my belly on the ground, and I'm like, if I could get something just to put under my chest to get my chest off the ground a little bit, I could lay behind a log or something and then just come up and shoot him. Or I'm going through all these scenarios in my head. I think I just need to be out there in the woods and I'll see the right setup. But that's the one thing I'm still struggling with is, and I think anybody will, is trying to find the right spot at the time. I'm not going to be able to choose the location, really. The bird's going to gobble, and I'm going to have to settle for the general area I'm standing at, or if I want to move closer to get to that general area, I'm going to just have to deal with what the cards are dealt. But I've been going through the scenarios in my head, trust me, different ways to, I can shoot sitting flat on my butt. I've practiced that. I can shoot with my bow horizontal, like laying across my legs and just come up to my belly and draw and shoot. I don't have to release from my cheeks or my face. And I'm pretty accurate out to 15 yards like that. I would prefer the traditional canted pull back, touch the corner of my mouth or whatever and release. But I know I got a little extended there. Trust me, this has been something going through my mind for a while now since I committed to doing it.
No, all those points is just making my wheels spin in my head because you're not using any type of seat. You're just walking out there and sitting on the ground or laying on the ground and practicing. You talking about laying on your belly. I've never tried to practice that. Like maybe just joking around the yard with some buddies, but it makes sense having turkey hunted for years now and been successful running a gun in with a shotgun and have killed birds in a blind with a stick bow. To me, you're right. Like anytime you're in a different piece of property or especially different states and different terrain, you just got to deal with what you got when you're running a gun and especially doing it without a decoy. So you're not pinpointing that bird in a specific location. And a lot of that too is probably for you. And you think it's luck too, where they pop out at, like you're hoping they're going to do that. And you're trying to play the road or whatever the terrain is to guess where that bird's going to use and be funneled into, but you don't always have that. That benefit.
One of the strategies that's crossed my mind, or it's in the back of my head, if the situation presents itself, is you call from one spot, he's answering, he sounds like he's interested, he's going to come that way. And then you advance 20 or 30 yards, and you just wait for him. And he's going to pass by you because they're going to want to get to that where they can pinpoint exactly where you last call. I've had them so many times where I've gone quiet, and the last time I called to them, they were 150 yards away or so. And then they finally appear 20 minutes later, 25 minutes later, and they walk to 15 yards and stop and look right at me. And so I thought about that. Okay, if I got one that's interested, maybe I call, move forward 30 yards, especially if there's a big tree I can get behind, or a fallen tree or some brush. And then I just basically ambush him as he's advancing to where he last heard me call. I'll be able to shoot him as he passes by. I've pretty much reserved a lot of time for my Minnesota hunting. Like, I've had people ask, hey, man, we're going to go hunt Minnesota this year. I was like, I don't know. I'm trying to reserve a lot of days, because I think it's not going to be something I get on day one. But when I'm hunting with a shotgun, we usually kill, or somebody I'm with, we usually kill on average every other day, 50% of the time. Mm, with great. A recurve, I think me hunting by myself, the recurve trying to film this too, that it may take 10 days for me to get an opportunity, and then I may blow it.
Yeah. So, and if you remove the camera out of there, you probably increase that, but not by much. I mean, that's still everything you're trying to do.
The camera part of it, when I'm going to be filming just like I normally do. That's the other thing. A recurve is so much more difficult to maneuver through the woods with. A shotgun, I just throw it over across my chest, the sling, and I'm hands-free. My recurve, they likes to grab every little twig when it's, you know, stick goes in between the string and the limb. Right. It's just a pain to move through. And I'll be filming, but I'll be filming the normal way as like I would with a shotgun, except for when I get set up. I will most likely put my main camera, it'll be on the tripod. I will probably add a sling to it so I can carry it over my shoulders while I'm maneuvering through the woods. But I will set it up behind me, and it's shooting in 4K, and I will zoom in a little bit but get a wider angle if I've got time to set it up. And then I'll put my 360 nearby. So I won't be operating the camera when I'm set up to shoot this turkey, but I'll have cameras running, recording the whole time. And the way my cameras are set up, I have long extended time run batteries, big SD cards, so they'll record for 6 hours continuous. If I just hit record and I'll set up, and if 30 minutes nothing's happened, then I may turn them off and move to another spot. But that's what my strategy is right now.
It's a good one. Yeah, trying to hit record and dealing with that on, off, any of that movement, it just
That's the question I get from people all the time. Is, hey, man, what are you using to turn your cameras on? So are you using the app? Or I said, no, I hit record and they roll. And I don't worry about them. So that even it's if better. I'm sitting there against a tree and about to take a nap, sometimes I'll leave at least one camera rolling.
And just let it keep going. That's great. So what is your bow, arrow, broadhead setup for turkey, or what are you going to use this year after you're starting to perfect it?
I'm going to use the same setup I've been using for deer and the other turkey I shot. It's a Zwicky two-blade, the old-school broadhead. My arrow is, I think it's, now I'm drawing a blank because I help my daughter with her bow too, so a lot of times I forget what I'm shooting. I think it's a 500 or 400 spine.
Okay.
Or 500, one of the two. They might be 400. It's shooting so much better now that my buddy Garrett helped me with it, because I could not get rid of some knock high, or the tail kept kicking up.
Yeah.
And I noticed that a little bit, and I took it over to him. I killed that Miriam's with it, that setup. And sometimes it would fly straight, but every once in a while it would kick off like it was kicking off the riser, and I would move my knock around. Finally, he told me he served a little knock below the other knock.
Okay.
And what was happening is my arrow, when I would release, it was sliding down the string.
Yeah.
Quarter inch, half inch. Yeah. And then kicking up the riser.
Yeah, serving was it wasn't thick enough to serving it. I'll tell you another trick that somebody taught me when you're in the field. If something happened, maybe you lost one of those knock points, or you had another setup, you can take dental floss and you can tie it around where that knock and build it up with dental floss. And if the cheaper the kind is, the better kind, and use a little lighter, and it'll singe everything together. And so it actually holds up for a while. Some people that are a little OCD don't like that, but they'd rather reserve it, but you don't have necessarily a serving tool or serving in the field with you. And so it's a helpful thing to have. Usually you got dental floss with you if you're traveling.
Yeah. It's a lighted knock. I like using lighted knocks just so I can see exactly where the arrow goes and find my arrow after the fact. But also for the camera, when people watch, and there's nothing more frustrating for me to watch a bow hunting show, whether it's traditional or compound, and they shoot and I cannot see the arrow one bit. I like seeing the arrow exactly where it goes and it hits the deer and turkey.
Yeah.
And so, and for myself, if I'm struggling to, I'm tracking a deer I shot, I like to be able to see exactly where the arrow hit so I can decide on wait times. But That lighted knot doesn't grip the string as tight as, say, one of the, like, a regular knot. Yeah. And he just served basically a bump underneath it. So it still fits loose on the string, but now it's got a knock, a brass knock above, and then a serving knock below. That's just like a D-loop, like between a D-loop.
Yeah, a lot of new string builders nowadays are doing that for traditional bows. It's very convenient and nice, especially if you've served one, you can twist it up and down. I'm sure you know that. So that's even more convenient when you're trying to tune on the fly. So is there any bucket list hunts for Shane right now? Is there anything that you got turkey-wise, maybe long-term, that you're like, man, I would love to go on this hunt at some point in time, but you just haven't done it yet?
I don't think there's like any location or place. I'm not trying to get all 50 states and stuff. My bucket list right now is getting a Eastern wild turkey with a recurve. If that goes well, I have some preference points saved up for Florida. Maybe I can draw a quota hunt next year. And maybe I'll be tempted to try and get an Osceola with my recurve, no blind, no public, all that good stuff. If that's my bucket list right now, the Eastern is. And then if that goes, then the Osceola becomes a really big bucket list. But as far as going to locations or anything, I'm content going wherever there's a turkey that's gobbling. One thing I have no interest in, and a lot of people go to Yucatan Peninsula or whatever to chase the oscillated turkey to get like the World Slam. I have no desire to chase that bird at all, because from what I can tell, you don't call them in. They don't gobble. They usually hunting over a little ag field or a bait pile or something. And then to me, that's just ain't doing it for me. I'm not spending all that money just to basically just check a box to say I killed one. I have no interest in checking boxes. I want to hunt turkeys and play that game.
Yeah, and have more time to do it too, right?
Yeah, it's all that money. I could travel all over the country for that amount that it costs to go down there to shoot that one oscillated.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying. Completely understand. I hope that Eastern hunt works out this year. Then on to the Osceola, that'd be special. Especially get it on film so we can all enjoy it.
Yeah, I hope the footage turns out okay. Because for me personally, whether other people are interested in seeing it or not, if I get like the Eastern in Minnesota this year with my recurve, I want to have that memory to go back. And I just want to be able to watch. I think it'll be a cool. The way I'm picturing in my head right now is my camera set up behind me about 10 yards and me laying down behind a log or something and then coming up and like Rambo.
That'd be sweet, man.
Showing that arrow just fly away from me and impact the gobbler and I get him. That would be such. Yeah,
that'd be killer.
I'm sure it's gonna be totally opposite of that.
What that everybody won't get to see is the 12 days before that of you putting in some sweat equity and just grinding and having some mishaps.
I will probably include bits and pieces of that. I won't drag out the episode too much, but yeah, a lot of people, they look at my videos and they say, man, you make it look so easy. There's a lot of stuff that's edited out because no one wants to watch me hunt for 10 hours to get a goblin.
I don't know. Some people would. Some people enjoy that. Now it's just changed so much where you get on YouTube and you can spend, I don't know about you, but you get on there and start watching some turkey hunting videos. And next thing you know, you're watching Tim Wells blowgun a baboon and you go down this dark hole and you're on there for hours.
Yeah. I have had people, I've had feedback from hunters or viewers. Some of them like the more condensed versions. Some of them like the longer versions where it shows more of my progress or process. And I thought about, when I start editing a hunt, there's 6 hours of footage and multiple cameras. And then there's an audio track and stuff from a lab mic and then the audio from the main camera. I start chopping it up and whittling it down to a 15-minute episode. And I could easily make it into an hour or longer episode to show more of the content. And there's people that expressed interest in it. I said, you know what? I may start doing that. When I get it chopped down to, say, an hour to where it would actually be a finished video, just more about the process, and then chop it down to a 15-minute episode and upload both and put in parentheses the extended version or something for the long run and let people choose which one they want to watch.
That's a good idea. I like that idea. Yeah, and too, especially people that are wanting to learn, and they might be able to pick up on some small things that you do, some nuances that you don't even realize is natural for you if they watch that longer episode. That's a good idea. I like that. Sure. And people don't understand how much time and effort it takes for you to put into editing. It is. If it's six hours of footage, it takes so much time, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, depending on how much I want to make it a finished product. I could easily spend 3 8-hour days editing one hunt.
Wow.
And if you look at my hunts now compared to before, now they're, I don't put any text in it anymore. That always took up a lot of time adding. I'll put like captions if you can't quite hear what I'm saying. That's because that bugs me too. If I'm watching somebody's hunt and I can't hear them, at least put some captioning down there. I will do that, but I won't open up and put the date anymore. I don't put all these other special things in there. I will put some mapping occasionally just to give people a feel for it. But that saves a lot of time in editing, is adding all those extra graphics and stuff.
Yeah, it does. But, it's a lot. You spend as much time as you want to on it, right?
Yeah.
So what is, I think I know what you're going to say about this, but I'm just going to ask it anyway. The toughest, most challenging turkey to hunt, maybe state-wise or region-wise, that you've experienced, no matter what you're taking in the woods with you?
I've been asked this plenty of times, and my answer starts to shift around back and forth. Down south, anywhere down south, it's a little more challenging than, say, in the Midwest, Minnesota, Iowa, that sort of place. I don't think there's been a state that it's been like, just frustrated me, because I've had good success in Mississippi. I've had success in South Carolina and Alabama when I hunted there years ago. I was on birds the first morning. I missed one the second morning. I should have had a dead gobbler. He was pretty close. I don't, Virginia, I want to get back to Virginia because I didn't get to hunt there long enough. It was 2 days of hunting and we were on birds and hearing birds. They just weren't ready to cooperate yet. It was the first weekend of the season. I guess I really don't have a state that has really frustrated me. Now, with that said, if there was a state I'd be worried about that I haven't hunted yet, Arkansas right now, because the population is just so low there, I hear. I haven't heard anything good come out of that state. There's people are killing turkeys down there, don't get me wrong, but Arkansas is full of hardcore turkey hunters. And for me to go down there and join them on the public and expect anything other than failure, that's one thing that, and I still want to, I want to experience the challenge, but I know realistically that's probably going to be one of the hardest places to kill one on public in Arkansas. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, that does. Yeah, the factors that plays into the population, it's a good point. And we've seen a decrease in Georgia specifically, and they limited the number of turkeys. It was used to be 3, and they went down to 2 per year.
I want to get to Georgia. I haven't hunted Georgia. I want to get there one year.
You need to. There's some really good spots, some really good WMAs to hunt. Like I told you in the beginning of the podcast, we've got a buddy that is eat up with it. He is obsessed. If he fell over and hit his head, a turkey would pop out. I promise you that. He absolutely loves it. We'll be in the middle of the rut and deer season, talking about deer hunting and getting fired up. And then he's sending turkey hunting podcasts during that time. And he still likes to deer hunt. And I think he does it too, just to mess with us. Cause we're like, why are you sending us this right now? He loves it. He is. He's super passionate about it.
And I think I like the warm weather as much as I do the turkey. And more so because I live in Minnesota now. I grew up in South, I was born and raised in South Carolina, and I'm cold nature. I like the heat. And dealing with the winters up here, I so look forward to spring turkey hunting. Going to Florida right now, I'm looking forward. It's been mild this winter, so I can't complain about this winter. But I always look forward when I have a southern trip, where I can leave the 20s and teens and end up in the 70s and sun. Oh, I love that. Just as much as the turkey hunting.
Yeah, it is nice. This time of year, it is nice in the afternoons. You get home and it's in the high 70s or 80s. And it feels really good. Now, late summer, you're outside pulling weeds or cutting grass for hours at a time, and it's high 90s. You start wishing it was fall again pretty quickly. At least that's what I've experienced growing up in Georgia.
Here's one thing nice about living in Minnesota. What a couple of things. Other than there's no, you ain't got to worry about black widows and brown recluses and venomous snakes up here. You can turn over a log without looking for a black widow underneath it. But when I lived in South Carolina, it seemed I had to cut the grass every week. It didn't matter if it rained or not, the grass grew. Up here, it seems like the grass grows so slow. I don't know why, like yard grass. I don't know why, but I can cut the grass in an entire cutting season like 4 times. And it is so nice up here. I don't know why a yard grows so slow, but I can cut it and it'll be 3 or 4 weeks later. I still don't need to cut it.
Still don't have to cut it. Yeah, I enjoy it. The mindless work and cutting grass and getting out there, and you can think and listen to podcasts or devotions, and I enjoy that time. But you get close to deer season, and I'm just like, please let it get cold so this grass will stop growing, because I don't have to worry about this stuff anymore. Or you get into deer season.
I like deer hunting in the warm too.
That's right.
I go out west, and like I was out west deer hunting last fall. It was not in the mid 90s the whole time I was there. Still love it.
Yeah, I did too. I love it. I got there and sweated. It doesn't matter. That's right. Dealing with ticks and all kind of different types of bugs. Man, it's not always fun when that happens. You get on the South Florida now and you go turkey hunting this time of year, and the grass never stopped growing down there. It grows all the way through the winter. They're cutting grass, and it's Christmas Day, and they're out there cutting grass.
Yeah, that's got to be odd. I guess if I was to move down there, that would be odd to deal with basically summertime year round.
Yeah, it is a totally different climate. It's amazing what you can get in the United States and the variance.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you this: any kind of words of wisdom? I know you've shared a lot that we've talked about in nearly an hour we've been talking so far, but any other words of wisdom? It can apply to the traditional bow or just turkey hunting in general. Somebody new coming into turkey hunting, maybe hadn't killed a bird or has been struggling, what would you share with them?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, or the thing that instantly popped in mind, is practice odd positions. That's the one thing that we talked about earlier. But so many people get in the habit of just standing there shooting at a target, traditional or compound, doesn't matter. I like to sit down on my butt and try to shoot. I like to lay on my belly and try to, and that's hard too, trying to lift your chest up to shoot. That's what I would say. If you're going to, especially if you're going to hunt without a blind, you got to work on those oddball shots, because it's inevitable it's going to happen. You're going to get in a position where a turkey comes in from an odd position and you're going to have to turn, or you need to plop down in a hurry because one's close. So my words of wisdom when it comes to turkey hunting with a traditional, even though I don't have as much experience as many out there, one thing I quickly learned is expect the unexpected and prepare for that ahead of time by practicing for those situations.
That's good. And what do you love? What does Shane love about a traditional bow? It doesn't have to be for turkeys, it'd be for deer, whatever. What has made you drawn to want to pursue something with that bow?
I think it's the freedom of not having to aim and draw and hold a sight. It's like throwing a baseball. If I'm sitting there, I got a ball in my hand, I'm just tossing myself in my thoughts, and somebody says, "Hey, Shane, throw me that ball," and I just come up and throw it to them. That's the appeal. Why I wanted to be like, I don't know what you call it, if it's snap shooting or what, but that's appeal to me. No sights, just get it to where it becomes an extension of your body, that a deer walks up and you're just chilling out there against the tree, and you can just come up and shoot without having to wait for the. I think that's a big advantage over a compound, is the fact that I don't have to lock in and then line up peep sights and pins, or I can shoot under a tree. I can bend and torque my body certain ways and my bow certain ways. I don't know. I guess that's my thought. The freedom of it, I guess, is the answer I'm looking out for.
It is. It's really special. And watching that arrow fly, especially when you're looking at something that goes to it and it hits it, man, that feeling, I don't know if there's many more satisfying feelings than that. When it comes
to another aspect, I love to be able to watch the projectile in flight.
It is. It's so special. It really is. All right. You got a lot of hunts coming, and we hope you're successful and get some good videos. So you're going to post that on YouTube. I know people are going to listen to this. They're going to know exactly who you are, more than likely, but people that don't, for whatever reason, you're going to post on YouTube. You've got Instagram. Do you have a Facebook? Is there any other places that people could find the stuff that you're going to share?
They can find me on TikTok and then my website, ShaneSimpsonHunting.com. There's links to all those platforms there.
Okay.
So that's the easiest place to find me and all of the platforms I'm on.
Okay, that's perfect. And you said when we were texting, trying to schedule this thing, that you were making turkey calls. Do you sell those?
Yes, but I'm closed for the season.
Are you? Hung up shop. Out for the spring, right?
Yeah, I had so many orders. I didn't get much done this week. I had to scramble and go pattern my gun today. I had to make time for it because I had so many orders. And I knew if I didn't shut down the store that I was going to be sitting here until the time I left boxing up calls. And I just got to call it into it. This is the latest I've ever made mouth calls. And demand has been through the roof this year for whatever reason. I don't know why. My subscribers on my channel is grown some, but not threefold. And I've had about threefold, three times as much as sales this year. So I'm thankful for it. It's a little extra cash to travel and turkey hunt, but I'm still scratching my head as to why.
It's probably because of your knowledge and your skills and what you can bring to the table. That's and the type of person you are too. I just want to say thank you again. You could be making turkey calls right now or getting ready or planning a trip out or on X trying to figure out where you're going to go. And instead you're spending time with me and for this podcast that we do. So just thank you, Shane, for being a selfless individual and willing to sacrifice your time. Because at the end of the day, I think the time, we talk about it a lot, is probably the most valuable thing that somebody can give in today's world. At least that's my thought.
Yeah, man, you're welcome. And I enjoyed it, though. I enjoyed talking turkey. So it's not a huge sacrifice. I could have made 10 more owl hooters while I was sitting here instead of talking to you, or 20 more. But like I said, I enjoyed talking turkey. And I've really enjoyed this conversation, to tell you the truth.
Thank you, Shane. I have too myself. I told you then, and you said you're all right with it, I was going to read a devotion, but I've changed my thought. I'm going to read a real quick scripture, and you just tell me if you got any thoughts about it. And whether you don't, I'm going to close this in a quick word of prayer and let you get back to either making calls or put your stretch pants on and enjoy the rest of your evening or go to bed. I don't want to take too much time. So I'm going to read this real quick. It's Isaiah 43:18 through 19. So spring to me is a special time of year because Easter is right around the corner. And then too, you've got all this new growth that is taking place and everything has been dormant. And now everything's back to life. So in a biblical sense, it's obviously got some significant meaning. So Isaiah 43:18 through 19, forget the former things, do not dwell on the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you perceive it? I am making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wastelands. That mean anything to you, Shane?
Well, it means a lot to me. And that's why I look forward to spring, the new growth, the things that are coming out from their, not really a hibernation, but, and that's a place where we can all get in our thoughts. When we're not sitting there chasing turkey, we've got time to sit there. We can think about things. And like I told you offline, when I pray, a lot of times I pray to myself in my head, and I enjoy that, where I can say what I want to without feeling any thoughts about what someone's thinking about. I can just be me. Yeah.
Spring is
a great place for that.
It's a perfect time to be quiet, especially in this world that we live in, where you've got so much distraction and it's in your hand, being your cell phone, a little computer that's always being carried around with you, and the distraction never ends, especially if you are not intentional about it and you don't let it. So being in the woods, turkey hunting this spring, anybody that's going to go out and pursue what we are passionate about, what you are super passionate about, just to think about that. And if you can, leave your phone on silent. From a safety reason, it might be good to have it with you, at least tell somebody where you're at and be able to sit there and spend time with God. So if you don't mind, I'm going to say a real quick prayer and close this out, and I'll let you go. Is that all right?
It sounds great.
Dear Lord, we just so thankful for you and just this world that you've blessed us with, and the opportunity just to cross paths with some amazing people, and just the new growth that is upon us right now. And these amazing birds that you bless us with, and the passion to chase them, and just allowing us to have opportunities to pursue that in this country and have the freedoms to pursue our hobbies, Lord. We just thank you for that opportunity. I ask that you just be with those that are in pursuit for birds this spring, Lord. Just watch over them. Give them the wisdom and the discernment to make good decisions, and give them the patience that they need to be successful, Lord. But don't let them lose light of really the reasons that they are in the woods, Lord, and just continue to encourage them that you are there with them and guiding their life in every aspect, and to not lose that as being the center focus for their pursuit, Lord. I just thank you for Shane, the man that he is, the selfless time that he has given us tonight, Lord, and the man that he is at home and in his professional life, Lord. I ask you to continue to bless him, continue to guide his life, and be with him and watch over him, Lord. Be with him as he travels this spring, and just continue to just allow him to have opportunity to just share wisdom that he has learned in a field and all the wonderful blessings that you've given us in the wilderness, Lord. I ask that you just continue to be with those that listen to this podcast, Lord. Bless them and in every aspect, and just continue to give them opportunity to come closer to you. I thank you so much for everything. I ask that you be with us as we part ways tonight and just continue to forgive us for our sins. We just thank you for your son. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks, Shane. We appreciate it.
Yeah, man. I had a good time. I appreciate you having me on. It was a lot of fun.
For any listeners that are based in the Newnan, Georgia area, Southcrest Church is having a sportsman dinner on April 26th. The event is called the Beast Feast, consisting of a night of great food, music, fellowship, giveaways, and the keynote speaker for the evening will be Ned Yost. Registration is free at southcrest.churchcenter.com. Don't miss out on this opportunity to meet some new people who love the outdoors while fellowshipping.